Good, thank you all for your prayers. And you should have on your seats, it should have greeted you as you arrived, a handout on sanctification and transformation. Put your hand up if you haven't got one of those, and I'm sure one will wend its way. I've got a little easier on the rainforests than Paul, just the three sides. And a bit of space if you want to scribble notes. And the references mostly that we need will be there on the sheet, but you might want to have a Bible with you as well. We're thinking about sanctification and transformation. And with this series of four talks that we've entitled Seeing Salvation, you could say that what we're doing, certainly for the bulk of them, is asking the question, who am I? Who am I now that I'm a Christian? How should I view myself? How should I think of myself? And how should I act in accordance with that? And having thought already about our regeneration and our adoption, Paul's helped us think about that. Now we're moving on to, it's not really the next phase, but another perspective on our salvation, that being our sanctification, which may or may not be a familiar word to you. It comes initially from the Hebrew word kadosh, if you want to go digging around in your Hebrew Old Testament, or from the Greek hagios, if you're into the Greek New Testament, or if the Latin Vulgate is your preferred translation, sanctus, or in English, sanctified or sanctification, or holy. Because those two words, different in the English language, actually have exactly the same meaning. And you can almost use them interchangeably. The reason we sort of use both is because we don't have a passive version of the verb to make holy. We don't have one word for that. We don't have holification. We only have sanctification. So when in the Bible you see the word sanctified or sanctification or holiness or holy, you're seeing the same word group being used every single time. And the root meaning of the word holiness and the adjective holy is separation, as I've written down there. If you were to kind of strip away context from a word and just get its kind of most basic sense, when you see that word holy or sanctified, it simply means separate, or better perhaps set apart for a purpose, distinct. When we have people around for lunch, if we're doing baked potatoes or that kind of thing, and I'm involved in the preparation, I'll get the sort of pile of potatoes in front of me, and the first thing I do is just mentally separate off one of them for myself. Not physically, that would be too obvious, just in my head. And from that point on, that potato gets special attention. It just gets a little bit more scrubbing and cleansing than all the rest. Is that just me? It is just me. Or you lot aren't willing to own up to the fact that you do too. In the most basic sense of the word, you could say, I make that potato holy. In the most basic sense of the word, I set it apart for myself and for my purposes. But you know that a word never has meaning in and of itself. It only ever means what it means in its context. And so when we apply the word to God, it gets filled with a whole raft of meaning, a whole degree of substance that it doesn't have on its own. And that's where we need to start when it comes to thinking about holiness. We need to go back to the God who is holy. Because if we are holy in any sense, it's because he is holy first. So that's where we're going to start, with the holy God. And you will know that that is a title almost, I wonder, most often ascribed to God of all the adjectives applied to him in the Bible. He is the holy God. And I think we can think of that holiness in two particular ways. There are two facets, if you like, to that holiness that, as we break them apart, will just help us understand it in a bit more depth. First of all, he is holy in comparison to the world. So in Exodus chapter 15, you might remember back to Central Focus last year, the book of Exodus, as Moses leads the people in a song of victory, having watched God defeat their enemies as he drowns them in the Red Sea. They sing this song, and in verse 11 of chapter 15, they say this. They say, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness? So they have just watched God defeat their enemies. Pharaoh, the greatest power in the known world, has stood against God, and he and his armies have been defeated. And they reflect in the light of that, on that victory, and they declare God to be holy. They're saying, in effect, there is nothing that can compare with the God of the universe. He has no rivals. There is no God just quietly sitting on the other side of the cosmos who might come in, who could compare to him and do the things that he does. He is the only uncreated one. He is the only one who is sovereign over everything. He is the only one who is infinite above all things. He's the only one who is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent. The only uncreated one. The only one who doesn't depend on anything else for his existence. And so they say he is incomparable. Who is like you? The answer is no one. He's incomparable and he's exalted as a consequence of that. So you might remember Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah walks into the temple and is greeted by this magnificent vision of God. And he sees God and describes him as being high and lifted up, seated on a throne. And as the angels look on that vision, they declare that God is holy, holy, holy. He's the one who is high and lifted up above all. And I think we know something of that instinct. When we come across something that is distinct, that is other, that is incomparable, our instinct is to elevate it. You'll remember that iconic image of Bobby Moore just a few minutes after England have won the World Cup in 1966 with a Jules Rimet trophy in his hands, lifted onto the shoulders of his teammates. Something of that instinct coming out. Well, that is how God is. He is the one who is high and lifted up, incomparable, holy. So he's holy in comparison to the world, and he's holy in character. He's holy in character, which means that God acts, in effect, in accordance with who he is by nature. Whenever God acts, he acts in accordance with what he's like, what his essence is, and that means his acts are always holy. So they go on in Exodus 15. They say, "Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders?" God's holiness works its way out in his character so that everything he does is holy. All of his actions, all of his deeds, they're holy, or as they say here, they're glorious, a word that has a very similar meaning as we're going to see as we go on. He's always perfect. He's always pure. He's always righteous. In everything he does, he's holy. His character is holy, or it might be tighter to say his holiness works its way out in his character and in what he's like. Which, as an aside, I think means that we can say that God is holy in both the fact that he judges and that he saves. He's holy in that he judges and that he saves. So normally, I think, when we think about God's holiness, we're happy with the fact that that means that he's the God who has to judge evil. But the verses that I've listed that you can look up a little bit later on speak both of the fact that God is a God who, because of his holiness, cannot look on evil, but also of the fact that because he's a holy God, he finds a way to draw near to his people, to save his people, to forego his wrath. God's holiness means that he's the God who judges and saves. Which means, I think, that the caricature we sometimes give of God, that he is holy and therefore in some way aloof and distant and unapproachable, is not quite right. In fact, it's true to say that because God is holy, he draws near. The reason we can't draw near to God is not because he is holy, but because we are unholy in and of ourselves. That's the problem we have. We are an unholy people. And those verse references I've put down there ascribe to humanity that title, unholy. But of course, you will know that's just one expression of a broader theme in the scriptures, that we're sinful. We're sinful, we're unholy, we're unlike God's in the way that we act. Which is not to say that God holds us accountable for the fact that we are not incomparable. You can see the problem right away, can't you? If God is incomparable, then no one can be like him. He doesn't expect us to be like that, infinite, omnipresent, omnipotent. Those characteristics of God are what theologians have called his incommunicable attributes. He doesn't communicate those to them. He doesn't share his infinity with anybody else. Those are distinct to him. But we fall short of his holiness in that we don't share his character, his communicable attributes, his perfection, his righteousness, his love, his mercy, his justice. We are not by nature like those. God expects that of us. He makes us in his image. So he would expect those made in his image to be holy and to be like him, but we're not. By nature, instead, we are sinful or evil or unholy. And that has left us in the position of being profane or stained, unable to relate to the perfectly holy God. But because God is holy by nature, he has sought a way to sanctify his people, to make us holy again. He has made us perfectly sanctified or perfectly holy, which is something I think we get a glimpse of under the Old Testament. It's in the Old Testament. It's pictured under the Old Covenant. So remember again back to the book of Exodus last year as we were working through it. Remember back to Exodus chapter 19. And there, God, having redeemed the nation of Israel from slavery in Egypt, he's brought them out from under Pharaoh's tyrannical rule, and he's set them apart as a nation for himself. And in Exodus 19, verse 5, he describes them as his treasured possession, his holy nation. Think potatoes in one sense. Yeah, he's taken them out from all of the nations and he's made them his own. And then in verse 10 and onwards from that point, you see God requiring of them a holiness in the light of that. So he has come down on his mountain, his holy mountain, and he calls them to draw near to him. And in the light of that call, he tells them that they are to consecrate themselves. And so they're to spend time washing themselves and making themselves clean. They're to abstain from certain practices that would make them unacceptable to God. They are to set themselves apart and make them holy. And then what the holy God does is, from the top of the mountain, via the mediator that is Moses, he gives them the law, which is all about holiness, full of commands that God gives to his people, that if they live in obedience to them, will make them distinctive and will make them holy, will make them like gods. You remember that command right in the middle of Leviticus. God says, "Be holy as I am holy." So he gives them a whole raft of commands that will mean that they are set apart and holy like him, and a whole load of ceremonial practices that if they follow them will make them clean, things like washing and sacrifices that they're to offer, that will make them that distinct, pure, clean people in his eyes. But of course, all of those things in Exodus and Leviticus and the rest of the Old Testament law are just in one sense pictures. They're just pictures of the reality that is perfected under the new covenant. The new covenant wherein we are cleansed from sin. You see, like I say, all of those things are just pictures. The outward cleansing that God requires of us. Pictures that point us to a much deeper uncleanness that needs to be dealt with. That being the problem of our sin. You see, God is not essentially concerned with BO and that kind of thing. At least not enough to keep you out of the kingdom. He's concerned with sin. That is the thing that he is most concerned with above all, the uncleanness of our hearts and our sin. And so if I am to be a truly holy person, truly sanctified, then I must be forgiven. I must be cleansed from my sin and washed from within. But wonderfully, under the new covenant, that's exactly what can happen. So Acts 26 and verse 18, which I've written on your sheets there. That is the Apostle Paul talking to King Agrippa, speaking about the mission that he's been given to go to the Gentiles and to call them to turn away from their old lives of sin and towards God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. You see, God is gracious, he is compassionate, he is abounding in steadfast love. He's a God who forgives, and he's made that possible under his new covenant, such that when I am forgiven by him, I am sanctified, cleansed, purified. You might remember those wonderful promises in Ezekiel 36 of the new covenant. Ezekiel 36 verse 25, which says this, "I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleannesses." The sprinkling of forgiveness that sanctifies us and makes us holy. Definitively and once and for all. Not progressively and slowly over time becoming more and more holy. No, because I'm forgiven perfectly once and for all, I am sanctified perfectly once and for all. Which means that there is no longer any need for all of those practices that the old covenant laid out. We don't need to do the washing and the cleansing and the sacrifices and the various ceremonial practices. We are freed up for them all. They're all fulfilled in and through the forgiveness that Jesus Christ makes possible. And we need to note that it is all through Jesus Christ, which is what these verses in Hebrews show us. Hebrews 10 verse 10. It says, by that will, the will of God, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. And when he says there, those who are being sanctified, he's not talking about one group of people being progressively made more and more sanctified. He's talking about God's people throughout time, one by one, being definitively sanctified, those who are being sanctified. He's already talked about how God's or Christ's single offering has perfected once for all time. And what he's saying there effectively is that the atoning death of Jesus Christ, the offering of Jesus Christ as he describes it in Hebrews, achieves for us forgiveness, and that forgiveness in turn achieves for us sanctification. So I wonder if you, when you got to Exodus chapter 29 last year, were confused by the statement or the requirement of Aaron, the high priest, that when he... that before he went into the Holy of Holies, he was to have blood sprinkled on his garments in order that he might be made holy. My sort of instinctive reading of that was that when you sprinkle garments on, blood on someone's garments, it makes them messy, not holy. Or Revelation chapter 7, confusing words. Describe those who come through the tribulation are described as those who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. I don't do much of the washing at home, but I know this, that if Susie was to come home and find me washing our best white wedding linen in a pool of blood, lamb's blood, declaring that I thought it would make it white, I don't think that would stand up. I think she might be mildly miffed. What it's saying here, you see, is that the blood of Christ applied to us, the blood which speaks of atonement, blood in the Bible always speaks of atonement. When that blood is applied to us, we can be forgiven because of Christ's atoning death, and in turn, sanctified, purified, cleansed, and made holy, such that all of the sin in our lives, past, present, and future, which so stains us and leaves us shameful in God's sight, guilty in God's sight, it is all by the blood of Jesus Christ washed away once and for all. I'm holy and sanctified definitively. William Cooper wrote this wonderful poem. He said, there is a fountain filled with blood, drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. The dying thief rejoiced to see that fountain in his day, and there have I, though vile as he, washed all my sins away. You see, the Christian is someone who has been perfectly set apart by God, washed and cleansed, and made like him, holy. And that is true, as I've said a couple of times, definitively. Theologians describe it as positional sanctification. I'm going nowhere. I am perfectly holy in God's sight. And it gives me great confidence. We've already had questions, haven't we, about the prevalence of sin in our lives, the way it so pervades our experience. We know that even as we go on in life, sin will be an ever-present. But I can have absolute confidence that because of the blood of the Lamb, I am washed and cleansed and made holy. Indeed, it gives me great assurance because that sin and its presence in my life constantly bites at my assurance and my confidence. It eats away, doesn't it, over time. My conscience gets heavy. But even my conscience, says the writer to the Hebrews, has been cleansed by this blood, if I will fix my eyes on it and believe in its effects. It gives me confidence, it gives me assurance, and wonderfully, it gives me purpose. It gives me purpose, as I am consecrated to God. We said, didn't we, at the beginning, that a good definition of holiness is separated for a purpose. That's what the word consecrated has a sense of, set apart for a purpose. And under the new covenant, that's what happens. So 1 Peter 2 that you've got written down on your sheets there, echoing actually Exodus 19 that we talked about a few moments ago, says this of the new covenant people of God. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvellous light. You see, God has chosen us And he has set us apart. He's treated us specially. He's cleansed us and washed us and made us his own. And he's set apart to be holy. But not to be, I think, a wrongly so-called holy huddle. You know that phrase that communicates a kind of an aloofness or a distance whereby we retreat. We gather on a Sunday and a Tuesday and a Thursday night, and the rest of the time we're in our homes, not really mingling with the world. No, because we're holy, we're consecrated and set apart for God's purposes, which are to go towards the world, to proclaim the excellencies of God's. After all, that's in keeping with his holiness. His holiness is perfect and pure and righteous, but his holiness is what makes him come towards us. So too, as we mirror that holiness, we should go towards the world. Which is not to say we become like the world. No, that holiness means as well that we are distinctive and set apart from them in our behaviour. But our attitude to them is not therefore one of distance or separation off. We want to go towards the world in order that we might proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness and into his marvellous light. Now, all of that happens in union with Christ and by the Spirit, and we've kind of been inferring that all the way along. And if you want to look up those verses later, do. But we're going to keep moving on. And before you break and do some thinking for yourselves, we're just going to reflect on two things. First of all, the unbelievable privilege that this sanctification brings. I think often when we think of our holiness, or the concept of holiness, we think of something that is perhaps boring, or at least that makes life boring. You know the phrase, a holy Joe, someone who's kind of, spends their Friday evenings at home doing nothing, maybe reading their Bible at best. That's what we think of as holiness. It makes you inherently boring. Or perhaps we think of holiness as being a burden that we have to carry around with us. The world gets to have such a lot of fun, but we as Christians have to pursue holiness. Or we think that it's something that might make us kind of sanctimonious or self-righteous, holier than thou. But I hope as we think about God's holiness and the way he's made us holy in his presence, we can see what a privilege it is. I stumbled upon some words from 2 Peter chapter 1 that kind of blew me away when I read them for the first time. He there in that letter describes us as those who are partakers of the divine nature. Partakers of the divine nature. Which is to say that God, in and through Jesus Christ, has, as it were, invited us into his essence, to share in his character. He's the one who is transcendent and exalted above the whole created order. He's the one who's pure and perfect in his character. And yet in his mercy, he has invited us to share in that, to partake of it, and to become like him, and then to live it out in his world. And when you think of what we're like by nature, how we are unclean, how we are stained, unholy and unworthy, unable to relate to him, it's an amazing privilege to be given holiness, the privilege of pursuing holiness and then serving him in the light of it. We serve, as it were, at his majesty's pleasure, which is not something that the non-Christian can say. It's an unbelievable privilege, and we have unhindered access. To be a Jew under the Old Covenant was a position of remarkable privilege, but I can't help but think as I read the book of Leviticus, it must have been seriously hard work. You know, all of that washing all of the time, and all of the offering of sacrifices, and the poring over the legal code to make sure you had the right sacrifice at the right time, the right priest offering it to you at the right time of year. It must have been wearying, despite the, in one sense, the privilege of it. But we as new covenant people have all of those things taken away. We don't have to be people who wash ourselves and offer sacrifices all of the time. Instead, we can, without hesitation, walk unhindered into the presence of God. If you like, the Holy of Holies has moved into our hearts, as God has, by his Spirit, moved into our lives. Paul talked about it a little earlier, this presence that we enjoy, this holiness that is ours, the fact that we can draw near with faith, as the writer to the Hebrews says it, meditating on what God has done, hearing his voice in our lives, praying to him without hesitation, constant and unhindered access. And if you're anything like me, you don't make the most of it as often as you should. Well, those are things we can talk about more, but for the moment, I want you just to stop and have a little breather. And we've got a box coming up, which means you do the work for a few minutes. So again, in those threes, fours, fives, whatever best suits you, pairs if that's easier, just in 10 or so minutes, have a think about those three different questions, and then we'll come back together. And that might be a conversation you want to keep going over lunch. But we've been talking basically about sanctification as a status, if you like, that is given to us. I am sanctified. I am holy. Like I say, we've been talking about it in that positional sense. But you might be thinking to yourself, doesn't sanctification affect the way that I act? Doesn't sanctification as a term have a bearing on my behaviour? And you would be right to think that. The New Testament certainly gives it that sense. We should be those who are pursuing sanctification or holiness. Next big heading on your outline there. And the way that the New Testament does this is in effect by, I think, saying to us, be who you are. Be who you are. And it says, therefore, you have been sanctified. You have been sanctified. That is the big way that it encourages us to behave in a certain way, by reminding us of who we are in Christ. So in the book of 1 Corinthians and chapter 6, or in the book of 1 Corinthians as a whole, you will know that there are many occasions where the Apostle Paul exhorts that pretty wayward church towards behaviour of all sorts of different kinds. And in chapter 6, in the verses immediately prior to the verse that I've written down there, he lists a whole collection of immoral behaviours. And then he says these words. He says, such were some of you, but you were sanctified. I want you to behave in a certain way. So now you need to know that you were sanctified. Not you are being progressively made more acceptable to God, more holy, more pure. You were sanctified. Past tense. You see, the story of the Christian church, the story of the Christian person, is the ultimate kind of rags to riches story. You see it told time and again. It's My Fair Lady, Pygmalion, Pretty Woman. The story of the girl who is plucked from obscurity, from plying her trade on a street corner or living in degradation in the slums. She's lifted out of that setting and given all of the privileges of a life of luxury. She's washed, she's cleansed, she's beautified. That's who we are in Jesus Christ. But in each of those stories, there's always that moment, isn't there, where the girl goes back to her former setting and she looks and sees that street corner where she used to buy her trade, or the slum that she used to live in. And the contrast is sort of horrific as she looks at what she used to be. And as she considers the contrast, she's the prospect of going back to it in any way is just abhorrent to her. Well, that is how we're to think of ourselves. We are that beautiful girl, washed, cleansed and made holy. And when we come to our sin, we're looking again at the squalor and the degradation of our former life. And it should be abhorrent to us as we realise the squalor and remember who we are. As we do those two things, remembering, realising how squalid our former life was and remembering who we are, the sin that tempts us and rears its head in our lives should become both inappropriate and unattractive to us. And that's the challenge of these verses. That's what Paul is wanting the Corinthian church to do, to remember who they are, to remember that they are now a sanctified people, washed, cleansed and beautified. And as they remember that, so then to kind of recalibrate their conscience, to recalibrate their estimation of sin and their desire to follow it. And just as the Paul would want that for the Corinthian church, so he wants it for us. So that when that internet pop-up comes and you're tempted to click on it and follow the links all the way through to a website that you know will lead you astray, you should think to yourself, hang on, I'm someone who's been washed. All of that degradation and squalor has been cleansed from my existence. or when you're at Thursday night drinks with your colleagues or Friday night drinks with your colleagues, and that third and that fourth round of drinks is being brought and everyone is heading in only one direction, we should think to ourselves, I have been purified, set apart perfectly for God's purposes. Or when the gossip is flying around and there's a juicy morsel coming your way or a bit of information you know you could pass on that would make you part of the in crowd, we should think to ourselves in that moment, I'm sanctified. I'm perfectly set apart by God and made holy for his purposes. And as we remember that, we will do what Paul encouraged the Roman church to do, which is to present our members as slaves to righteousness. As we remember that we have been sanctified, so we will be sanctified. So Romans 6 verse 19, Paul says there, now present your members as slaves to righteousness, leading to sanctification. It's as though, kind of, as we remember who we are in Jesus Christ, so that will have a bearing on who we become in the world. We will become sanctified. The story is told of the queen when the her children were very young, the princes and princesses. Every time they would go out to a state occasion, she would sort of put the finishing touches on them to make sure they were presentable. And as she would sort of tie the last tie and that kind of thing, she would look her children in the eye and say to them, remember, royal children, royal manners. Royal children, royal manners. And there's something of that in what Paul is saying here. We remember who we are. Remember who you are. You're a sanctified person, set apart for God. Let that make you act like a sanctified person, leading to sanctification. In Paul's scheme, you might say he has told us that our inner person has been renewed, washed and cleansed and purified. And so we should live in line with that new inner person. The Spirit has our heart now, and he's set our mind in a new direction. As we live in line with that, so that will begin to have an effect on our outer person, the war that rages inside us. As we remember who we are by nature, so the battles will become won, and we will be sanctified in actuality and not just in status. Not, I should say, in such a way that makes us more acceptable to God. No, we have been perfected. It's a once-for-all thing. Our kind of outward holiness does not have a bearing on our status as far as God's concerned. But it is something that pleases him, and it is something that makes us more like Christ as we go on. I am inwardly perfect, and as I remember that and live it out, I will be outwardly changed, leading to sanctification. David Peterson, in his book Possessed by God, which is possibly slightly dull, but very good on this subject, he says this. He says, sanctification is not only a gift to be received, but a life to be lived as we yield ourselves to be conformed to Jesus Christ in his death and resurrection. Not just a gift, but a life to be lived. It's a nice summary of how sanctification works. And he makes the point that we're transformed into the likeness of Jesus Christ, which means that the qualities that we pursue, the holiness that we want to attain, is not just an abstract set of qualities. No, we're becoming more like a person, which is, I think, a really helpful thing to think, because it helps us in our sanctification. We sometimes laugh at it, and it's not always a helpful thing, but those bands, WWJD, there's something to that. The Christian can think, what would Jesus do? Because his is the holiness that I am pursuing. I'm being transformed into the likeness of Christ. And we'll say more about that tomorrow when we think about glorification. But point four there. There is a reason to pursue holiness. The writers of the Hebrews says that it is so that you might see God. So that you might see God. And this verse here from Hebrews 12 is quite a challenging one, I think. Because he says there, strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Now, before the sirens start ringing on the cars of the legalist police, let's just see that this is what he's saying. The writer to the Hebrews has already done positional sanctification. He's already made it very clear that in Jesus Christ we're perfectly washed. We have a perfect status that will guarantee our salvation. But now he's saying, strive for both peace and holiness. Strive for sanctification. And it's this sanctification without which no one will see God. He's saying, if you like, that there is a fruit that is required in the life of the Christian. And if there is no fruit, if there is no holiness in this sense, then there's every chance that the root is dead as well. And so as God's holy people, we should pursue sanctification. And so having reassured you, I hope, of your perfect status in Christ, let me now exhort you to holiness and to a wholehearted pursuit of it. You see, I think, and this might be true of my generation, particularly in the church, but I think sometimes there is a casual attitude to holiness. Sometimes it's it kind of comes out of good motivation, a desire to avoid legalism, perhaps, or a desire to kind of be relevant to the world in such a way that we can share the gospel with them. But I think we have become at times casual in our pursuit of holiness, as though it's uncool to be kind of putting to death sin. That is something of the burden of the book that Kevin DeYoung has written that was recommended to us by Jonathan last night, The Hole in Our Holiness. He recognizes in the church at whole a casual approach to holiness. But this verse from Hebrews would mitigate against that. We should be those who take godliness very seriously and take holiness very seriously, always keeping it grace-based. We don't want to cut the pursuit of holiness off from the moorings to the grace that drives that holiness in the first place. It's always grace that will motivate and produce true holiness, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be pursuing it wholeheartedly. William, when he talks about this, he does it more often on a Sunday evening, I think. He takes great relish in talking about sticking the knife into sin. I think he's sort of reliving his army days as he does it. But he sort of sits there with a glimmer in his eyes talking about how you put to death sin, you stick the knife in. And there's something to that, I think. We should be like assassins of sin who kind of are looking for sin in our lives and eager, because of the grace of God that's been shown to us, because of the sanctification that is ours, to jump on it and to put it to death. To have nothing more to do with it, to kill the habits that keep on rearing their heads, to pursue the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Peter Adams spoke to the staff team at the beginning of the year. He talked about, he said something like this. This is not quite right, but he said something like this. He said, if you're not killing sin, then it's killing you. And I think there's some truth to that. If sin is, it's like an ivy or a fungus. If we let it go unchecked in our lives, then it grows and it grows and it grows, and it can take control. So we need to be those who are pursuing sin. So I think it would be a good thing to do this weekend, when we've got a bit more space and a bit more time, to stop and do what the Bible would call examining ourselves. Too much introspection is, I think, unhealthy, but there is a healthy sense in which we should examine our hearts. Perhaps, we'll put it differently, we should examine our consciences and ask ourselves, is there anything in our lives that weighs heavily on my conscience that I'm just doing time and again, and I know that it's not right? And as we do that, we should stop and think about it, and then meditate on the purification that's gone on in our lives, and then pray and ask for God's help in putting it to death. Because like I say, or like the writer to the Hebrews says, there is a holiness without which no one will see the Lord's. Indeed, we won't see the Lord, nor will we, fifth and finally, bring glory to him. Back to 1 Peter 2. We've seen these verses already, but let's finish with them. He says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. He goes on just a couple of verses later, and I apologize for the fact this didn't make it onto your handout. He says this, he says, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, or you might say holy, so that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of his visitation. You see, the wonderful thing is that as God's holy nation, set apart and distinct for him, proclaiming God's excellencies as we live out that life, and adorning those excellencies with our good deeds in front of the world, we're like a light on a hill. That's an image the Bible uses, isn't it? Like a light on a hill shining. And the world will be like moths drawn to that light. Not universally necessarily, but in numbers. They will be drawn in as they see our holy lives and hear our holy proclamation, attracted by that wholesome holiness, and then compelled to obey the gospel that produces that holiness. And that then will bring great glory to the God who's done it all in the first place. And I don't know about you, but that's what I want to do with my life. Why don't I say a prayer and then we can have some questions. Heavenly Father, we praise you for what you have done in us through Jesus Christ. We thank you that his blood was shed, that you paid the price in that way, that we might be cleansed from the inside out. Help us never to forget that, Lord. Indeed, help us to reorientate our thinking about ourselves so that we are those who consider ourselves to be your holy people. Keep us from getting dragged into the way the world acts and thinks of themselves. And instead, help us to be holy and set apart. In our behavior, Lord, help us to be distinctive morally in a way that is in keeping with your character. But in our attitude, Lord, make us those who want to go towards the world in compassion and with mercy, holding out the word of truth to them. And we pray that all of that, Lord, would reflect back to you much glory everlastingly. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
We've got some questions here that you could ask, and we want to have a bit of time for questions. I don't know what the best way around to do is. Clark, you got any thoughts?
Questions from the floor
for 5 minutes, and then we've got a 10-minute window, and you can start some conversations that might carry you into lunch. So, any questions? Charlie?
Just one moment. In your talk, you said that your generation has a problem with holiness. Why particularly that? Is it something we all struggle with?
Yeah, no. And don't let you know, if you're not my generation, whatever that means, don't consider yourself off the hook. I just think there is a seriousness in my parents' generation. That might be the distinction that's helpful. There is often a seriousness about sin and about holiness, and about pursuing it. That in my generation, we're just kind of more relaxed about it. I suggested a couple of reasons I think might be the case. Sometimes I think we're just so nervous of legalism that we're very nervous, therefore, about exhorting one another to pursue a certain lifestyle for fear that the person we're exhorting might think we're being legalistic with them. And we've kind of, the pendulum has swung too far in one sense. A big thing in the church at the moment, which I think is a helpful emphasis in some ways, is a thing called contextualization, which is where you kind of, because of a concern for the lost, you want to kind of become like them where you can. You want your churches to reflect the world. And there's something healthy about that, and we could talk more about it. But there can be an unhealthy side to that, whereby we actually become like them in every sense. Now, that's born out of a good desire to reach the lost. But it means we can compromise on things we shouldn't compromise. Things like, drinking, I think, is a big one. My parents' generation, many of them would have been teetotal and would have thought of the idea of having a drink as a bad thing. Now, I'm not saying that's good, but the pendulum swung a long way now, so that in my generation, we don't think twice about going to the pub and often having more to drink than we should do. So, you're not off the hook if you're of another generation, but I think it's a problem that we've got at the moment. Anand?
When Paul says, I do what I don't want to do, i.e. he keeps on sinning, and then when we say, actually, put sin to death, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, is it possible to put sin to death, i.e. close, or is it that one just continues to, I don't know, how does one put sin to death, actually, given that we continue to struggle? So is it possible for a particular sin to be closed off, and then to move on? What does he mean by victory, actually?
So the question, correct me if I don't get it quite right, but I think Anand's asking, is there any sense in which we can, what does it mean to put to death sin? Will we ever, can we ever actually fully mortify sin? Either particular habits or totally?
Yeah.
Paul in Romans 7 says, I do not do what I want to do. And what I want to do, I do not do. Now, we could debate about Romans 7 and what we think that means. But generally speaking, let me give you some thoughts. I think the Christian life, to the day we die or to the day our bodies are redeemed, is going to be marked by battle with sin. So I think, for what it's worth, Romans 7 describes an authentic Christian experience. But if you don't like that reading, Romans 7, then I think Galatians 5 bears it out as well. And so the authentic Christian life is marked by sin. And what Paul wants to do, I think, in Romans 7 and Romans 8, is actually say the source of encouragement to the Christian is not necessarily the victories over sin, it's the fact that there's a battle raging within you. If the Spirit of Jesus Christ is changing your desires, then he who gave life to Jesus Christ will also give life to your mortal bodies. So the work of the Spirit in your life causing a battle is the source of encouragement, not necessarily the victories. But I think at the same time, the New Testament does give us an expectation of victory over sin, not necessarily, in fact, definitely not total and lastingly, sad to say, but it does give us an expectation of progress in some ways, and an increasing Christ-likeness. So that the 70-year-old Christian will not be a perfect person. They will not have got rid of the effects of sin in their body, but they will be more like Christ than they were 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I think the realistic expectation is one of battle and of progress. And I think the progress may sometimes be up and down. Paul might talk about this a bit more when he talks about assurance. The progress might actually be up and down. You know, the line, the trajectory, whilst upwards, may not be straight upwards. We might see ups and downs over years and that kind of thing. But it will still, I think, we should expect it to be an upward trajectory. Do you want to come back on that? Or Paul, do you want to add?
I suppose when he says put sin to death, sounds pretty conclusive.
Yeah.
State,
right. So I think he's talking in a kind of so put to death sounds pretty conclusive, says Anand, and he's right. I think he's talking in a kind of in the sense of the moment by moment battle with sin. So in any one moment, put it to death and move on, not get rid of all the sinful side of your existence. That's not going to happen until the new creation.
Tony, the grammar does that, so it's present, continuous. It's,
okay,
it tells us itself that it will be an ongoing thing that we have to keep on doing to put it to death.
Yeah, which is very helpful. So this is Romans 8, should we turn to it? Romans 8, 13. So I used to find this verse a bit discouraging, actually. Paul says, if you live according to the flesh, you will die, but if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. Which does, on that translation, sound definitive and kind of once and for all. But a better translation, I think, would be, if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the body, you will live. That's a better translation, and not just because I like it more, but it's truer to the grammar, I think. And more encouraging, because it's describing not therefore a once for all victory, but an ongoing battle and ongoing little victories along the way. So if your life is marked by a battle, then be encouraged, because you will be given life to your mortal bodies. One more question, Ruth, and then
we talked a bit about legalism. It might be useful just to hear what's your view of the tipping point, or what does legalism look like as opposed to, you know, and sort of seeing piety and self-righteousness. What does it look like?
So Ruth's question is, what does legalism look like in practice? If we thought a bit about license and what that looks like, and that would be quite a healthy conversation to have amongst yourselves, because we've all got those legalistic tendencies in our hearts. But I guess a couple of thoughts would be that it's just devoid of grace. It's devoid of grace in its attitude. So why am I pursuing righteousness? It's to attain righteousness so that I might be found righteous in God. It's to get a righteousness of my own, rather than remembering that I am righteous. The foundations are very different. And so that will work itself out in all sorts of ways. So I think legalism will be marked by a kind of a fear, an uncertainty, because I can never be good enough. So the person who's kind of insecure in their relationship with God, there might be lots of reasons for this, and I don't want to come down too hard, but it might be because there's a legalist streak that means you're never quite sure about your relationship with God. It might work its way out, I think, in a self-righteousness or a judgmentalism. So if you are justifying yourself, then the best way to do that is by comparing yourself to others. If you can look at others and see how bad they are, that will make you feel better in yourself, and convince you that you're more righteous in God's eyes, and so you'll become judgmental of others. It might mean that you're evangelistically aloof as well. You don't want to be stained by the world, so you won't go to the places that they go to. Might be lots of other things, lots of other ways it works out. But I think that those are three ways legalism might come out.
Jamie, that's hugely helpful. Thank you. I think what we're going to do so that we can make it to lunch on time is that we're going to sing now.